Yes, welcome to the last session of this conference. And first, I'm delighted to introduce Ferenc Erős, who's Professor of Social Psychology at the University of PEX. He writes, among other things, on identity, prejudice, intergroup relations, and history of psychoanalysis. And I thought I'd show his... You've heard about this one before. He's co-editor of Ferenc Jones Correspondence. And then he's contributed to this one, Ferenc and His World. And also to the second volume, Ferenc Time. And to this book, Psychoanalysis and Politics, Exclusion and the Politics of Representation. And also the forthcoming book, Nationalism and the Body Politic. And finally, he's co-organizing the next Psychoanalysis and Politics conference that will be in Budapest next year. 9th, 10th, and 11th of May. I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you. Sorry. Do you hear me? Yes? Well, I mean, I try to speak as loud as I can, and you can. Thank you very much, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation of this fantastic and wonderful conference. Thank you for Judith and Tom. I belong to the minority together with Tom, who are not psychoanalysts, but nevertheless, we try our best to show our interest in psychoanalysis. And the title of my presentation is Freedom and Authority in Clinical Diary. And I have a few PowerPoint presentations, PowerPoint images, which might help you to follow my presentation. Ferenc's Clinical Diary is an extremely rich and complex work that should be analyzed from very different aspects. Its significance goes far beyond the boundaries of psychoanalysis. It has several important implications for present-day social and political sciences as well. I refer, for example, here to our chairperson, Lina Auerstadt's works, who used Ferenc's and, among others, Balint's trauma theories for understanding the unconscious roots of social prejudice and exclusion in a very original way. She recently defended her thesis at the University of Oslo. Since Ferenc had no intention to publish the clinical diary, he had the full liberty of playing with ideas, associations, and feelings that were not yet quite molded into proper discursive form. The advantage of this way of presentation is that it allows a unique insight for the reader into Ferenc's innermost subjectivity. The difficulty is, however, that the insights may be sometimes disturbing, contradictory, or even dramatic experiences. In this paper, I'm proposing some directions for reading and rereading, as it was already discussed before, rereading Clinical Diary, focusing primarily on its social and political implications, also for our present days, as already Julia Borosha was talking about these implications. Ferenc's diaries can be read and interpreted in many different ways, just like Freud's interpretation of dreams. And I quote the American historian Karl Schorske, who writes that about the interpretation of dreams, that its deep structure constitutes an incomplete but autonomous subplot of personal history. Imagine Saint Augustine weaving his confessions into the City of God, or Rousseau integrating his confessions as a subliminal plot into the origins of inequality. I go to the next picture. Clinical diary can be read as it is, as a genuine clinical diary, as it was the intention of Ferenczi, a diary of a psychoanalyst on methods encounters and therapeutic experiences with patients, the identity of most of them had been already identified, as it was shown by Billy at the first part of this conference. Secondly, it can be read as a series of personal confessions about his own relation to patients, to Freud, and to the psychoanalytic movement as such, and to his inner thoughts and feelings about the world. Thirdly, since there are many autobiographical references in the text, it can be seen as a life historical narrative, however fragmentary and incomplete it is. Fourth, it can be interpreted, as it was already discussed before here, as a metaphysical treatise, the relationship between body and mind, which goes back to Ferenczi's early interest and continuous interest in spiritualism, in suggestion, hypnosis. As well, it goes back to this phylogenetic theory or phylogenetic fantasies, which had been outlined in Thalassa, but it was already discussed with Freud in the correspondence during the First World War, when Ferenczi was sitting in a military garrison and doing nothing, just thinking. Five point five is that, and I quote Ferenczi, the mentally ill person has a keen eye for the insanity of mankind. That is Ferenczi in the clinical diary. And it is, the clinical diary is a very provocative essay on madness. And with Lacan's words, and I quote Lacan, the mirror stage, Lacan words, not only on the madness that lies behind the walls of asylums, but also the madness that deafens the world with its sound and fury. And it is from Lacan's mirror stage. Ferenczi's thoughts on insanity anticipate, I think, the anti-psychiatry of the 1970s and the 1980s, and maybe some ideas on schizophrenia and the desiring machine by Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari in the Anti-Oedipus, but we could talk also about Lacan's contribution to the history of madness. Sixth point is that clinical diary may be read as an essay on... Oh, sorry. No, it's, I'm coming to six. Sorry. Sorry, it's not the same. I'm not so very good in mathematics. So I have to, yes, I have to. But a clinical diary may be read as an essay on moral philosophy, a foundation of a psychoanalytically informed ethics, which is not based on moral prescriptions and blind following of norms. And I quote again Ferenczi. There is also a second source of mutual goodwill, more primary, natural, and non-neurotic. This behavior of feeling, however, apparently so highly ethical, has none of the pretensions of the writer's adult. It is merely a psychic parallel to one's own unimpeded physical and mental growth. So it is no particular achievement, nor is experienced as such. Such perfect happiness, and I stress this expression, that perfect happiness was perhaps enjoyed only in the womb. Ferenczi regards excessive goodness as a manifestation of overcompensated sadism of obsessional neurotics. Similarly, as Lacan put it in the mirror stage, we place no trust in altruistic feeling. We who lay bare the aggressivity that underlies the activity of the philanthropist, the idealist, the pedagogue, and even the reformer. That's Lacan. There might be, more parallels between Ferenczi's ethical standpoint and Lacanian ethics. They both agree that there is no such thing as an ethically neutral position. The analyst cannot avoid having to face ethical questions. Lacanian ethics was as the subject to confront the relation between his actions and his desire. Ferenc's ethics demands the unmasking of hypocrisy on both sides of the couch. Only when hypocritical mysteriousness in sexual matters has ceased to exist, when everyone will know of the process of his own body and mind, that is, only with conscious cathexis will sexual emotions be truly mastered and sublimated. I don't want to go into details to the problem of ethics, because I think it should be a long discussion, but I go farther, and I would say that Clinical Diary may also be read as a politico-philosophical essay, similarly to Freud's group psychology and the analysis of ego. Ferenc was not a homo politicus. Nevertheless, similar to Freud, he was full aware of his responsibility as a psychoanalyst towards the whole society, not only towards the patients, but towards the whole society. And I am quoting here a strange sentence from his review, which was published in 1921 as a critical review on Freud's group psychology and the analysis of ego, where he writes, "For in dealing with patients, the physician is representative of the human society. Like the Roman Catholic priest, he has the power to loose or bind." So it's an interesting statement, and it's maybe not accident that he mentions the Roman Catholic priest and not, for example, the rabbi. And why he speaks about the Roman Catholic priest, because maybe Catholicism is a universal religion, and he wanted to refer to the universal responsibility of the priest, and also the question whether the psychoanalyst has the power to loose or bind. It is also an interesting ethical question, which I think worth to discuss. But to understand the political implication of the Clinical Diary, it is important to outline very briefly the broader context of this work. 1932. We are in 1932. It's a very, very common year, I think. Nothing happens, but it was a critical year in the European history and Ferenc's life history as well. For example, it was the last year before Hitler's seizure of power. The last few months, because in January 1933, Hitler is elected chancellor. In Italy, Mussolini already rules in the 1920s. In Hungary and in Austria, semi-fascist, anti-Semitic governments are forming just in 1932. In Hungary, Gyula Gömbös, in Austria, Engelbert Dollfuss. In the Soviet Union, which was, an interesting place for psychoanalysts in the 1920s, and we know that Freud referred several times to the Soviet experiment, the illusion of the future of an illusion. In other words, the totalitarian system, the Stalinist system, consolidates the ultimate end of the cultural flourishing of the 1920s in Russia, in the Soviet Union, and of course it was the complete end of the Russian psychoanalysis. I just refer to the book by Alexander Etkin about the history of psychoanalysis in Russia. Of course, we all know that there was a long economic crisis, as usual. And we always live in the era of the economic crisis. And among European intellectuals, there is a general disillusionment, as always, anxiety and fear of what Ferenc previewed, as they use as an interesting expression, the blossoming of gangsterism, the blossoming of gangsterism. And I just refer to Freud's work, which deal with similar anxieties, the future of an illusion, civilization and its discontents. And let's turn to Ferenc's life. in Ferenc's life, well, it was already discussed a few times in this conference. Certain years have passed since in 1919 Ferenc became university professor appointed by the communist government, the Republic of Conscience, and shortly thereafter he suffered so many humiliations for being Jewish and for accepting the position from the communist government. And we have to add, I think, we were talking about Radu, and Radu, Sándor Radu, was had an important position in the Ministry or the People's Commissariat of Education, and he was very helpful in promoting Ferenc's appointment to the university post. 9 years passed since the rank debate on the birth of trauma that resulted into a long-lasting rupture in the psychoanalytic movement, and I have to mention here the impact of the friendship with Grodek, with Georg Grodek, and the challenge of the soul-seeking, which was the title of Grodek's novel, and it was the friendship with Grodek. This topic was already touched in this conference. The invention of the concept of the Weissbibi and the theme of the enfant terrible. And I again quote Ferenczi, and it's a very famous statement, adults are relative idiots. Children are all-knowing. So we are all relative idiots, thanks to only relative idiots, but we have to add to this list that it was the time of deteriorating physical health and the confusion of tongue with Freud and the psychoanalytic movement, the Wiesbaden crisis where he presented the confusion of tongue, the paper, even if most members of the secret committee or the committee did not want him to give this lecture. And it happened, this conference took place not long before the last entry in the diary on 2nd of October 1932 with the title The Terror of Suffering. The Terror of Suffering. In Clinical Diary we find several passages that describe Ferenczi's attempts to outline a political philosophy, the main concept of which is individual collectivism, that is a successful interaction of egoistic and universal tendencies. The notion of individual collectivism goes back to his early, more explicitly social and politically oriented writings on education and criminality, namely Psychoanalysis and Pedagogy in 1908, Psychoanalysis and its Relevance for Legal and Social Sciences, 1913, and it's just the volume which was shown by Lena, the book Ferenczi and His World. I already discussed the significance of these essays, so I only briefly summarize them. The most important concept in this early period by Ferenczi was the notion of unnecessary constraint and surplus repression. This means that repression in our society requires not simply a minimum of instinctual renunciation, but also the subjugation of the members of the society, including deprivation of their human dignity and autonomy. Surplus repression, according to Ferenczi, sets free those instinctual forces which lead to religious superstitions, to the cult of authority, and to a rigid adherence to obsolete social forms. In other words, the consequence of surplus repression is the insanity of society, that is to say, collective neuroses. In Psychoanalysis and Pedagogy, for example, he argues that the liberation from unnecessary inner constraint would be the first revolution that brings genuine relief to humanity, while political revolution results only in transition of external power or means of constraint from one hand to the other. Only people liberated in this way will be able to bring about radical changes in pedagogy and thus prevent the reappearance of such conditions. And in Psychoanalysis and its Relevance for Legal and Social Sciences, he speaks about a sound individual socialist direction that is somewhere between anarchism and communism and which serves not only the interests of society, but also the happiness of individual. Again, the word happiness, happiness in the social womb, maybe. Though after his 1919 university adventure and the fail of both revolutions, the so-called bourgeois revolution and the socialist revolution, he seemed to be withdrawn from political affairs, or at least from directly from political affairs, but he did not give up his liberal socialist or individual collectivist conviction. In order to demonstrate how deeply Ferenczi was involved with the problems related to social political trends and formations of his age, let me introduce here two short handwritten manuscripts in Hungarian, which I found here in the Freud Museum, and it was part of the material donated by Judith Dupont to the Freud Museum, and I was happy to have been able to make photographs of this material, some of this material, last time I was in London. So let me introduce here two short handwritten manuscripts in Hungarian, stemming probably from the 1910s. The first one is the parallel between Marxism, communism, and anarchism, and the next one is parallel between psychoanalysis and liberal socialism. I'm not sure that I could read the Hungarian text fully, but I could pick up main ideas from this. In the first draft, he argues that communist ideal would correspond to what psychoanalysis calls fatherlessness, while the anarchistic paradise would cover the other side of the psychoanalytic elimination of inhibitions. However, the goals are rather different, since communism and anarchism want to liberate instincts, while psychoanalysis aims at the self-liberation of the individual. The above parallels suggest that Ferenczi had only some vague ideas about Marxism. Nevertheless, the parallels had been drawn in the second draft, the parallels between psychoanalysis and liberal socialism. Shows that he was familiar with the ideas of another 19th century philosopher and economist, namely of Henry George. At that time, Henry George was a very influential economic thinker. His most famous book, Progress and Poverty, was published in Hungarian in 1914. It was translated to many languages. In this book, George made the argument that a sizable portion of the wealth created by social and technological progress in a free market society, a free market economy, is possessed by landowners and monopolists via economic rents, and that this concentration of unearned wealth is the main cause of poverty. George considered it is a great injustice that private profit was being earned from restricting access to natural resources while productive activity was burdened with heavy taxes, and indicated that such a system was equivalent to slavery. He made the case for a land value tax, a tax in which governments would tax the value of the land itself, thus preventing private interests from profiting upon its mere possession, but allowing the value of all improvements made to the land to remain with investors. In short, George's program called for liberating production from taxation, the earth from monopoly, and humanity from poverty. So George had many followers in that time, especially in Britain. First of all, the Fabian Society, where such famous people belonged to as Sidney and Beatrice Webb, Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells, Leonard and Virginia Woolf. He influenced, among others, Joseph Popper Linkeus, the Austrian engineer and utopian social philosopher whose theory on dreaming was acknowledged by Freud as being very close to his own dream theory. Popper Linkeus envisaged a society where people can dream without being forced to repress the real meaning of their dreams. George strongly influenced also Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, who in his utopian novel Old New Country, this Alt Neuland, envisaged a happy communitarian society on the Palestinian land. Henry George and his ideas had been immensely popular among Ferenc's contemporaries in Hungary, progressivist radical reformers, free thinkers. George's theories, along with others related theories like that of Marx, Darwin, Herbert Spencer, they were all rivals in winning and convincing the progressive thinkers. And of course, these philosophers and economists had been widely discussed in the forums where Ferenc also lectured or published, for example, in Galilei Circle. During the parallel between psychoanalysis and liberal socialism, Ferenc relies on George's ideas. According to Ferenc, the anachronistic fixation to land, which resists to industrialization, prevents the elimination of the rule of landlords. Therefore, it may correspond to the incestuous fixation to the mother and the tyranny of the primitive father. On the other hand, the treatment of land as a pure commodity causes the concentration of wealth in the hands of the few. Psychoanalytically, it corresponds to the helpless repression that is an obstacle of real development. Ferenc acknowledges that these parallels have only a very limited value, though he emphasizes that psychoanalysis and liberal socialism as a common world view. Returning to the critical diary, I am arguing that in this fragmentary text, many traces of the idea of liberal or individual socialism can be found, even though there are no direct references to the economic theory of Henry George, as I mentioned before. For example, he writes on the 152nd page, "If one were not ashamed to indulge in prophecies, we are not ashamed to indulge in prophecies, then one would expect from the future neither the triumph of one-sided ruthless capitalism nor that of fanciful egalitarianism, but rather a full recognition of the existence of purely selfish drives which remain under control but must be partly satisfied in reality, the elimination of a great deal of neurotic, still passionate, one might even say violently excessive goodness, eat bird or die policy, and finally perhaps the gradual unfolding of a naive good-heartedness." On the 200th page, he notes, "Under the prevalent regime, rearing of children, passionate behavior of adults, it is made difficult for all people to free themselves of any sympathies or antipathies and the unfairness. Maybe someday the character of humanity will improve, limits of ability of change. Even science is passionate when it sees and recognizes only selfish interests. The natural urge to share feelings of pleasure following the corresponding normal satiation and nature's principle of harmony are not sufficiently recognized." This quotation suggests that there was a strong utopian element in Ferenc's thinking. He himself called his ideas as utopia, suppression of hate impulses, ending of chain of acts, acts of cruelties like blood feuds, progressive taming of the whole of nature through control of knowledge. It would be, however, too easy to dismiss Ferenc's thoughts as merely utopian. He died in 1933, just a few months, as I mentioned earlier, after the Nazi takeover in Germany, and he could not be a witness of the great social experiments which followed the world economic crisis, that is, the New Deal in Roosevelt's America, and the foundation of the social democratic welfare state after the Second World War in Britain and in other Western European countries. These experiences had been answers to the challenge of fascism, Nazism, and of course the East European or Soviet communism or state socialism, and they have proved to be successful inasmuch as they could guarantee a certain balance between, with Ferenc's words, ruthless capitalism and fanciful egalitarianism. providing some kind of basic trust for citizens, both as children and adults. Thus, liberal socialism was maybe historically not a utopia, even if from the perspective of today's dominant neoliberalism and also the grave shortcomings of the East European democratic transformation after 1989, the appearance of new authoritarianism, it seems to be a utopia again. Ferenc's main concern was in Clinical Diary and in other works to unmask hypocrisy in psychotherapy, in the family, and in the society, and reach a degree of sincerity which is the precondition of freedom in both individual and social level. His dilemma was the following: how to develop a non-authoritarian way of therapy based on mutuality and acknowledgement, in other words, a democratic relationship with the patients. How can this goal be achieved in a world where authoritarianism dominates, at least on those parts of the world which made Ferenc's life worth, his Lebenswelt? How psychoanalysis can be a remedy when even Freud could not liberate himself from his innermost authoritarian tendencies, since he lacks the basic sympathy towards the patients? His attitude was, according to Ferenc, the calm, unemotional reserve, the unruffled assurance that one knew better, and the theories, the seeking and finding of the causes of failure in the patient instead of partly in ourselves. And he adds, the anti-traumatic in Freud is a protective device against insight into his own weakness. Ferenc's inside or internal critique of Freud and the shed lights to the fact that early psychoanalysts as psychoanalysts, as citizens, had been growing up and socialized, educated in more or less authoritarian societies or dictatorships, as we know, for example, the interpretation of dreams, where Freud speaks about censorship several times. And they internalized the norms of the society. Their life world and their basic habitus, I'm using the expression of the French sociologist Philippe Bourdieu, the habitus had been formed by the state, by the government, by the power, even if their worldview was in strong opposition to the official ideology. In this world, trauma, as well, the negation of trauma, and the deadly silence, and I use again Ferenc's expression, the deadly silence around the trauma was more or less an everyday experience for most people. In this sense, Ferenc's Clinical Diary is a premature, but, and someone uses, I think, Franco's ejaculatio precox expression, I would say in a more polite way, a premature but heroic effort to change psychoanalysis and to transform it into a democratic practice based on mutual respect and acknowledgement. A decade later, and it was already mentioned and discussed a few times, it was the British School of Object Relations, the British Independent School, that Fulkes and Bayon and others, Winnicott, that had made profit from Ferenc's thoughts, even if they did not refer explicitly to him, and try to face with the challenges of a modern society in a more realistic and practical way, focusing on early childhood and attachment, family, social relations, group processes, poverty, exclusion of certain social groups, and so on. The institutions of welfare state, the development of mental health, social, family, and community care systems have largely was very much in line with the development of psychoanalysis in the Second World War. United Kingdom, I am just referring to Elizabeth Young Brewer's article, Psychoanalysis and Social Democracy, which was published in 2011, not long before her death. It raises many questions about the place of psychoanalysis in a modern or postmodern society and the relationship between the subject and the state or the government in a broader sense. I can only refer here to such works as Nicholas Rose's book, 1989, Governing the Soul, the Shaping of Modern Self, or Jung Brewer's works. As, for example, Nicholas Rose writes, citizenship is no longer primarily realized in a relation with the state, nor does citizenship inhere in participation in a single public sphere, even if it is understood as a diversified civil society. Rather, there's a range of dispersed and non-totalized practices within which games of citizenship must be played. In these practices, citizenship is primarily realized through acts of free but responsabilized choice in a variety of private, corporate, and quasi-public practices, just finishing, from working to shopping. Government mechanisms construe them as an active participant in their life. No longer is the political subject, though, to be motivated merely by calculus of leisure and playing. No longer is the individual, as far as the authorities are concerned, merely the possessor of physical capacities to be organized and dominated through the inculcation of moral standards and behavioral habits. In her article, Psychoanalysis and Politics, Historicizing Subjectivity, Lynn Layton, criticizing the continuous separation of the psyche from the social in psychoanalysis, formulates the following questions, and I just referring to these questions. Is there anything universal about human, about being human, and if so, how do we understand the relation between the universal and the historically situated? Is psychoanalysis a progressive and democratic discourse? What are some of the psychic effects of neoliberal discourses, and where does psychoanalysis stand in relation to these discourses? I would add one more question. How can we use Ferenczi's insight in our age for understanding unconscious social processes such as exclusion, prejudice, and hatred? And I just want to quote again Ferenczi, what he writes in Clinical Diary. All hate is projection, in fact, psychopathic. The paranoid mechanism may also manifest itself in the fact that the displacement draws ever wide circles and hatred in extended to a whole family, a whole nation, a whole species. As a result of the displacement and the projective quality thus associated with hatred, it will also be difficult or impossible for hatred to dismantle it philosophically as quickly as mourning, or slowly to be eroded in other ways. So this quotation shows that Ferenczi was at least as realistic as he was utopian. Thank you very much.
Hello? Yeah, do you like stuff? Yeah. I'm delighted to introduce Jonathan Sklar, who's a training analyst of the British Psychoanalytic Society, where he lectures on Freud and Ferenczi, as well as in University College London for the last 7 years. And for the last 10 years, he's run an annual psychoanalytic conference together with Mark Soames in South Africa, and teaches psychoanalysis also 3 times a year in Chicago. Between 2007 and 2011, he was vice president of the EPF. In his article, Regression and New Beginnings, Michael and Alice and Enid Balint and the Circulation of Ideas was published in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis in August 2012. And finally, his book, Landscapes of the Dark, History, Trauma, Psychoanalysis, was published by Carnac in the autumn of 2011.
Thank you, Lena. Can you hear me at the back? It's a pleasure to address you. It might be a pleasure to address you. I'm going to start off with a quote from Anna Akhmatova. In the fearful years of terror, I spent 17 months in prison queues in Leningrad. One day somebody identified me. Beside me in the queue, there was a woman with blue lips. She had, of course, never heard of me, but she suddenly came out of that trance so common to us all and whispered in my ear. Everyone spoke in whispers there. Can you describe this? And I said, yes, I can. And then something like the shadow of a smile crossed what had once been her face. I propose to take you on a meander, to be a flaneur, around the themes of alterity, the other, trauma, prejudice, totalitarianism, the things that we've just been hearing from Fehring, but in terms of the child, the adult, the family, the nation, and to think of it also in terms of failed and the possibility of being able to have mourning. So I'm going to look through the lens of European history, the violence and the tragedy of the 20th century. And one thesis is that such historical and social matrices have profoundly affected analytic societies as they've coped or often failed to cope with the ensuing terrors of the two world wars and beyond, and that such specific scars in analytic societies can often remain and still today cause disturbance and dysfunction. How does one develop states of freedom in analysis and in the analyst from the tangles of unconsciousness that exist in one's unconscious mind, within the analytic society that trained one, and from the surrounding unspoken depths of our European culture? Such complex matters range from the need for the analysand to find new ways of expression in both relation to himself and towards the other, as opposed to running along the old tramways laid down by one's personal history, caught up and repeated in the transference dynamic, to, in another order, the question of how best to develop a practice in a particular place, which may actually be very antithetical to such projects. This in the United Kingdom, probably across Europe, is certainly becoming more prevalent. The National Health Service here is getting rid of psychoanalytic psychotherapy at a very fast pace. A central part of the discussion must involve an examination of theory and practice of psychoanalysis and of analytic training itself, and they can both contain their own unconscious tramways. Yet the very theme of freedom, my associated word tramways, leads my thought to the train lines that led from so many countries to the death camps of Europe. European culture, like the human subject, has never been free of aggression, stretching from medieval times through what I want to say the so-called Enlightenment, culminating in the world wars fought on our soil in the 20th century. This was Freud's legacy. But it's undoubtedly our own, and has played a part in the evolution of psychoanalysis throughout Europe and beyond. Freud, living through the First World War, attempted to make sense of the mass slaughter of nationals, despite or due to cultural heritage, and, as we all know, had to flee Nazi Vienna in 1938. His sisters did not escape. They died in concentration camps. What would it have meant for the future development of psychoanalysis if the Nazis had killed the father? How can one think about trauma in the individual without thinking of it in generational terms, as well as in the terms of the cultural heritage that was the backdrop to the development of our subject, the Austro-Hungarian Empire? Europe has continuously struggled with the stranger coming from the East, ready to pollute and kill the Western order. Each country in their particular form has declared themselves historically as the bulwark against the horde. France, it's back to the Atlantic against the Germanic tribes, the Goths and the Visigoths and the Mongol horde beyond. Or Spain and Portugal similarly fearing the Caliphate expansion as a successful Muslim invasion created Al-Andalus. Or Germany fighting against the atheist communists in Russia, as well as the impoverished villages of Poland and the eastern states riddled with shtetl Jews. The conflict can be seen through the opposite lens, where the Roman legions spread the empire far to the east, or the many crusades invading the Middle East. All along, there's a knowledge that cities are what are really civilized, civitas, and the wanderer is impure, dangerous, stupid. Strong boundaries, then, are an essential component of the nation-state. developing the psychology of a them and us, and demonizing the other. The European Union, despite considerable internal stresses, has as its core value justice for all of its citizens, enshrined in the European Court of Justice and the Act of Human Rights, something that our present Prime Minister is determined to change and water down and get rid of. Anyway, these are ethical and democratic structures beyond the boundary of each of its states that are a profound answer to the vicissitudes and particularities of the individual nation state. Now, transcribe these states of prejudice, and prejudice is going to be, as you will find, a very important theme in what I'm talking about. Prejudice and unconscious fantasy to the individual in his family, prejudice in analytic societies, desiring to accentuate particular forms of theory and training, and in addition, the wish for widespread development of training where it's missing, can often neglect the analytic sense in an individual treatment, in which hard-won pieces of conscious knowledge act as a psychic pontilism, as development is a valuable patchwork that slowly joins together in some way. And I want to meander now to look at some of the patchworks in Europe. Can I have some water there? One question that became central to my role as Vice President of the EPF some years ago was how to preserve the integrity and difference of the EPF, European Psychoanalytic Federation, in the increasingly complex world of psychoanalysis, while in addition working with colleagues from other regions and the IPA. This priority is in addition to present-day concerns about the very survival of psychoanalysis as a treatment form in the current climate of quick fixes and business solutions. Looking back in history, psychoanalysis has invariably had an often unwelcome status, with Freud's concern that it could be attacked and demoted if the scientific community, as well as the state, the Nazi state, perceived it as just a Jewish theory. Freud never let go of the worry of the eruptions of the working of the unconscious life had a dialectic involving its return to a state of repression, especially if it became perceived as having a negative influence in society. One happenstance for psychoanalysis is that the unconscious is readily available, as it were, to subsist underground, as well as in the privacy of a dyadic relationship. I can now make a statement that it's impossible to destroy psychoanalysis. Its status is too present, especially delineated by how it's still regularly attacked, meaning it's worth attacking because it exists. It is clear that we're dealing in Europe with psychoanalysis in a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilingual set of complexities that are growing well beyond the bounds of an Austro-Hungarian historical model from Freud's day. The quest is to find analytic environments that are similar yet different to each other that can respect each other's work and thinking. For instance, there's now an analytic study group in South Africa, and I think it's absolutely appropriate that the beginnings of African psychoanalysis find their own depth understandings, encompassing their own histories, family, tribal cultures, magical prescriptions, and the vast outpouring of severe repression and trauma visited on that land for far too long with apartheid. South Africa is part of the European Psychoanalytic Federation. We spread out widely, includes places like India as well. It's all part of British colonialism, really. The task is great and profoundly necessary, utilizing the tools of psychoanalysis for clinical work and helping society to see its deep unconscious psychological wounds, together with the possibility of healing, not just the individual, but what we can do to say things about society. Many European analytical societies have also emerged sooner or later with profound historical traumas that for many of us remain part of our own lifetime. The biggest area of psychoanalytic growth at the present time in the world is in Eastern Europe, which as soon as the Berlin Wall came down, there was a flurry of people from everywhere in Eastern Europe, from Siberia and beyond, who were interested in the personal self, and to try and find in analysis ways of understanding what has been going on in their families for, you know, the last 100 years. So this is also causing immense difficulty, because there are psychosocial cultural tramways which exist in states of repression or by reckoning with history to allow the emergence of new orders. Language, as you will know, has its own Orwellian tones. For instance, Arbat mach frei meant its very opposite. So during the last century and into this new one, many countries with repressive governments have now seen generations of children who had to grow up in paranoid atmospheres at home, where there was a keeping silent in order that children should not be able to say anything dangerous that the family spoke about when outside on the street. Such protective social mechanisms can become what appears as an ordinary, sensible paranoia. Yet in the analysis of candidates growing up in totalitarian regimes, Nazi, Stalinistic, South African, the germ of the paranoia needs a special notice, taken as it's often ubiquitous, silent, and has the appearance of just being ordinary. The analysand needs to question not only their own history, but that of the analyst. Where has he come from? What has his imagined trauma been? But not by question and answer, rather by an examination of what became known in South Africa as truth and reconciliation that searched out the traumatic landscapes. Totalitarian regimes with deep controls embedded in social, political, and family life play their part in the unconscious dynamics of the 21st century cultural life, and our societies, analytic societies, bear these scars. War within some parts of Europe has only recently ended. I'm thinking about Serbia. The European tradition has its history, its deadness. The possibility of radical construction is also possible within an atmosphere of a capacity to criticize. But for this, you have to be able to tolerate the other without allowing domination, at the same time as recognizing complexity. In psychoanalysis lies freedom, or at least the potential for freedom, which includes the development of attaining a more mature position that recognizes the vitality of mourning. Creative separation together with mourning is a necessary element in the development of the parent-child relationship, the analyst-patient relationship, with unconscious communication enabling this to take place beyond and despite trauma. Where there have been substantial traumas and deprivations, the analytic situation is one that involves the possibility of new formations that require the bedrock of trust. This may lead to a sense of reparation that sometimes one does need to come from the analyst as a humane and free other who not only can think and understand outside the tramways, but can be alive outside them. The same will be true if a traumatized society is able to struggle to mourn its specific historical confrontations between colleagues rather than surrendering to low murmurings of discontent. And this is something I think that we saw this morning, where I think there was a historical confrontation which might allow the British Psychoanalytical Society to move beyond low murmurings of disdain of the other to finding that there is something in all our ways of thinking that is worthy of respect and discussion. Attempts at mourning in society at large includes the erection of symbols, often statues in prominent or less obvious positions for remembrance. But again, these can exist for glorification, for political dissemination, as well as standing as if they represented an invitation to remember. Working together across the boundaries of societies and countries is an eloquent and worthy model for such depth understanding. Given the traumas of European history and the often intolerant matrix of belief in analytic societies, this is bound to touch upon questions of mourning and might also provide a space for its expression. If such difficult psychic processes born of all our different but convergent histories of the 20th and 21st centuries cannot be reflected in analytic thought and practice within our societies, then where else? This was the central question that international psychoanalysis had to face about returning to Germany for the first time after the Second World War, and I'm thinking of the 34th Congress in Hamburg in 1985. What value was psychoanalysis if the analytic community could not face such profound difficulties? And it was an extremely difficult congress. Some of you here may have been there. I'm now going to tell you a story which I want you to listen to also as a metaphor. In 2010, I organized an EPF annual clinical meeting, a weekend for recently qualified analysts in Warsaw. So 28 analysts from different analytic societies all over Europe attended to present clinical work in small groups to a panel of training supervisors. The location was evocative. On the first evening, many of the participants enjoyed being in the beautiful old town square, which had been completely rebuilt in the post-war reconstruction. To many, the deception of being in the heart of the old city centre of Warsaw was unrealized, as it looked and felt so ancient and so well kept. A quarter of the city had been the container for the Warsaw Ghetto, totally razed during the 1943 Jewish uprising. The following year, most of the core central parts of the city were also razed during the Polish resistant partisans' uprising against the Nazi occupation before the Red Army advanced into Warsaw. 85% of Warsaw was demolished. The destroyed city, post-war, was lovingly recreated by copying Canaletto's famous views of the original city. We can read in this process the societal and cultural equivalents of how an individual's trauma is atomized and detached from the possibility of understanding such that it can only be viewed from the outside. Unknowing of its history, the visitor, and in this case, 27 young analysts, delighted in the perfectly reconstructed medieval environment. Yet, what is this Disney-esque reconstruction which hardly shows any link to its real past and its awful past? The pleasure is the refixed center points to the necessity to not remember, beguiled by the surface pleasures of eating in the old medieval square and drinking beer. Outside the castle in the center of the old town is a small photo that shows nothing of the vast building other than its forlorn gateway and a right-hand corner showing a tottering thin pile of bricks left in 1945. Nothing was left standing, and there was a sea of rubble everywhere, a horrid and eloquent metaphor of what had earlier happened. Where one now stood, time has moved on. This has symmetry with the neurotic individual who must repress that which cannot be made known because knowledge is too terrible to be made manifest. Knowing the destruction means that one has to gaze upon the view of something that has been wiped out. It exists in the negative shadow of what we see before us. Absence is the trace of the destructive order as part of the European city patch over the place where originally a rent had appeared. Freud put it in relation to psychosis, as you probably know. Quote, the delusion is found applied like a patch over the place where originally a rent had appeared in the ego's relation to the external world. Unquote. The city cannot bear to contemplate the tear in its own past and its population as well unless courageous mental work is undertaken. Such patches of architectural memory can be found all over Europe, the only partly recognized signs of a missing history in many important landscapes. It has not been easy to build edifices that enable us to mourn our bloody European heritage, which provide an atmosphere to facilitate mourning. Germany has had a long journey on this path, from the Mitscherlich's important book, The Inability to Mourn, in 1967, which analyzed the failure of the German people and society to acknowledge the crimes committed in the name of National Socialism, to the Berlin of today. Mitscherlich's earlier book, The Doctors of Infamy, The Story of Nazi Medical Crimes, was published in 1949 and so inflamed much of society there that large numbers of this edition was bought up by the German Medical Society in order to suppress it. This in itself has its own evocative history. Looking at Berlin monuments, which exist to remind citizens of totalitarian past, There are two which strike me as being of particular interest, although one I think is only truly significant or effective. The first is at Babelplatz, the site at which, on the 10th of May 1933, the Nazis burnt the books, including Freud. It now contains a monument by Misha Ullmann. It consists of a small glass window set flat into the cobblestones that looks deep into the underground into an empty library with rows of bare shelves, with a line of Heine, where they burn books, they ultimately burn people. Evocative, certainly, yet as one walks away from the site, it becomes invisible from any distance. The ordinary passerby is not even aware that it's there. The event's certainly remembered, but only if one's standing right on top of the spot. The dictum, out of sight, out of mind, comes to my mind. Either knowing of the existence of the place of the destruction or just coming across it, although this can have a very powerful effect, yet it's a monument in Berlin that it's very easy to ignore and not notice. The other monument is Peter Eisenman's construction commemorating the Holocaust, 2,700 enormous concrete slabs nearby the Brandenburg Gate. This is a public work that's not hidden away, but daily in the sight of all who pass by the very center of the city. It points unequivocally to that which is known and must be seen. It's unavoidable, and an essential part of the regeneration of national soul and spirit by the constant confrontation with destruction. The prose of Akhmatova at the start bears testament to daring to be able to describe that which is nearly too painful to bear to be brought into the present in words. And yet, as she said, it can be done. We can relate the question of historical trauma and how it's registered in or refused by the mind to the analytic process. All crises, historical and personal, are at once endings and beginnings. In time, the existence of a crisis allows the development of thoughts, both of its origin as well as how it may end. There is always something unpredictable and potentially even radically unsettling about this. To take a metaphor, the apparent simple commencement of a Beethoven symphony can evoke an unconscious expectation, not just of its development, but how the composer will dare to end what is created. Great works often end in a dissonant way in relation to our milder, more humdrum expectations, exposing the listener to the shock of another different resolution. Similarly, free association contains a potential for a radical edge that can move us away from the neat hedgerows of the narrative plot of known object relationships. Instead, it allows us to find ourselves in a dissonant landscape, and not necessarily the one we would have tried to creep into. With understanding, free association can place us at such cardinal positions, and we then have to try and understand where we are. These are different places from where we want to be, desire to be, or where society often demands that we should be. This is the reason why all totalitarian regimes, in their control of society, detest the possibility of one thinking for oneself. They prefer the group narrative, which is far more easily controllable. Psychoanalysis does not deliver cure, but its instruments enable the possibility of Brave to examine the contents of Pandora's box in order to find hope in knowledge. As Frank Kermode, the famous English literary theorist, who died a couple of years ago, suggests in his important essay, The Sense of Ending, The Sense of an Ending, quote, "This is not, after all, quite the world of those who seek the courage to be and strip reality of the protection of myth," unquote. It's a continuing struggle for the analysand to find that state of being which is distinct from immersion in one's primary narrative. Analysis can be an act of freedom against the chains of imposed and self-imposed narratives from family history and unconscious romance, but it also has to struggle against the passive expectation that something will be done by somebody else, which often expresses itself as a desire to this to be the analyst's function. We have the possibility of developing a new European analytic dialogue, which in its openness would be truly in the spirit of Freud and Ferenczi's legacy. The capacity to speak together ethically is the best way of preventing authoritarianism. in our analytic practice, as well as in the future of European history. A brief example is the problem around being able to listen to a colleague describing their own clinical work, utilizing a theoretical frame that might differ considerably from one's own. To only listen within a singular theoretical construction may well mean that the ideas, direction of treatment, use or not of regression, of having a historical developmental understanding or not, may profoundly impact on how one hears the other. This arguably is an ethical problem, as it requires a particular type of listening, similarly described as how the analyst listens to the analysand, with evenly suspended attention, without knowing where one is going. It's very similar to a colleague this morning who spoke about going into analysis in a state of being naked. You don't quite know what's going to happen. If you take your theory in advance, of course you well know, but then you won't reach another place. So this may well require relinquishing particular knowledge of how one unconsciously theorizes in order to be able to meet the other in discourse. Of course, it's so much easier to invoke one's own theoretical stance to attack the work of the other and to avoid having to think in a different way. This is particularly important in our world today with its recent and continuing global financial crisis, exposing the return of the repressed world of selfishness and the need to re-find an object to blame, be it the Taliban, Muslims, the religious right in America, and always the ubiquitous Jew. As many European societies lurch more to the right, and it's frighteningly happening, and human values seem to be polarized into a primitive dichotomy of us and them, the specter of totalitarianism returns to haunt us all. More than ever, an analytic thinking space is necessary as one form of resisting the lurch into domination both in society and family life. So let me return to the theme of prejudice, and some of my thinking comes also from Lena Alstead's recent PhD on the ethics of prejudice. We can discover another level of application of Ferenczi's confusion of tongues in the psychosocial and group formation of the way alterity is abused. The all-too-common varieties of prejudice, seen variously as racism, anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim, anti-the foreigner, the anti, just the anti, I'm against them, I'm for me. These all contain similar core psychodynamics. Ferenczi pointed out that after the assault by the adult on the child, a further twist, a further nasty twist, a further attacking twist was perpetrated by the child being blamed for what the adult had done. Guilt was projected, and the other, in turn, is whitewashed into a state of innocence. I didn't do this. Look what the child made me do. It is this mechanism that readily offers itself as a solution to the racist. The victim is told that the particular understanding of what the perpetrator has done is actually the construction of the victim. It was, after all, just a joke. It wasn't an anti-Semitic attack, but the victim's exquisite sensitivity. You know, those poor Jews, they're so sensitive about anything that anyone says. This is the regular dynamic of alteric attack, with the victim knowing that they have suffered something, but with the perplexity of feeling that despite happening in the glare of daylight, it goes unacknowledged and something feels really bad that one's left with. Not just the attack that's been done, but the sense that the person doing the attack seems to think that nothing untoward has happened. This leads to further degradation of the other in society. So this Ferenczian theory can be a key concept in sociopolitical activity. We can use it to speak out for the outrages that are becoming more familiar to all of us in the 21st century. I'm nearly finishing my journey. I want to bring in Seamus Heaney, who died a few weeks ago. In his volume of poetry in 2010, The Human Train, he writes of the need to find an appropriate balance of contradictory position. Quote, the need on the one hand for a truth-telling that will be hard and retributive, and on the other hand, the need not to harden the mind to a point where it denies its own yearnings for sweetness and trust. Unquote. We're back in a contrapuntal world of words that need to be spoken and longings that must be recognized, a world that might be thought of again in terms of Ferenczi's elasticity, his expression, as we've heard this weekend, about tact, holding the tensions as they differ from time to time, both in an analysis and within society. Before I end this paper, I'll sum up some of the clinical considerations within the scheme of the value and importance of history in psychoanalysis. I've drawn connections and links between mother's own history and the transgenerational unconscious system. The centrality and necessity for a maturational state of mourning is highlighted both in society and in the privacy of an analysis, whether refinding the lost object or, for some severely traumatized individuals, finding the object for the first time is the essence of our analytic work. And now there's a question about how to end. The end is ever present in our living out of a life, for the individual and for society, as well as for the individual in analysis. Death is a certainty of the condition of being alive, even if for many it remains unknown to consciousness. This, I would argue, needs to be part of any analysis. The imagined death of the analyst, the analysand, as well as the fusion of those two strands into the end of the treatment. We die, and we will be in the minds of those we leave behind. Similarly, the end of an analysis leads the dyer to both have in mind from time to time, à la recherche de temps perdu, remembrances of things past. The individual runs mythically from moment to moment, whilst our culture runs in grander aliquots from year to year, the century, the pull of the millennium. The IPA recognized its century as if the survival of psychoanalysis, and not its longed-for death, is contingent on the magic of 100 years, not incompatible with the idea that psychoanalysis as a discipline, a mere 100 years old, is still a child or adolescent. Commode contrasts big centuries of time with the insistent ticking of the clock that pulls us along our journey from birth to death. The commencing movement in the sound tick he described as a humble genesis to the more guttural sound of tock, a type of feeble apocalypse, and the pause being the gap of life in between. The narrative structure is directed in a formulaic direction from then to now. Tick, tock, tick, tock. Commode then suggests we might instead hear the sequence differently. Tock, tick. Tock, tick. In this tiny metaphor, he breaks through to dissonance and invites us to view the well-ordered sequence as a potentially fragmented noise. Of course, the life of an individual can be conceptualized in its forward-moving dynamic. Yet, if we are to think about the structure of beginning and end and insert the tock first, the time interval, despite being the same, carries a very different resonance. It contains dissonance, which is the stuff our patients bring to us. But more so, Commode is pointing to the danger of being complacent, to being in a torpor, that all seems well as society moves in the direction of totalitarianism. The clock needs resetting in its perceptions of the dominance of dissonant rhythms. The tick-tock is a human narrative to fill the void of time as the clock moves ever forward. Psychoanalysis has a freedom to mentally escape the shackles and to go backward in time where necessary in order to refine the lost objects or history of the patient. This is the value of après-coup, or Nachträglichkeit, that allows the possibility of going back in time and unconsciously re-evaluating etchings of the mind. Refinding lost objects is, of course, in itself another mythical quest, but one in which there can be a rebalancing of what can feel like a magical drive of destiny, so that the individual may own more responsibility for his or her own causality. I've nearly finished. This means moving out of the groove of a slavish, unconscious drive to continue the life one's grown up with, including its perceptions, misperceptions, prejudices, as if our character and object relations have been fixed, by the contingencies of life as something concrete that cannot, must not be altered. Beneath the fantasy that things are fixed for all time resides the fear of, and then what? What is to be made of life in the empty space without the patch that seems to hold it together? This is a place where psychoanalytic dialogue can be formative, allowing the concrete patch to be prized away so that a new healing can begin, to be able to have the freedom to have an adventure, to be alive in one's life, and to include being alive even as the long shadow descends into the dark. Thank you.
Is it working? Hello? Yeah. Thank you both for those two really wonderful papers. Yes, I feel we should be discussing this for hours and hours, really. That's so much. But maybe I just open the floor. Should I? You can't hear. Wasn't that you wanted to say something, no? All right, yeah, I'll have to stuff it very close. Okay. Yeah, but just, you know.
I haven't been at the conference earlier, so what I say might just have been covered before. I was struck by listening to both papers one after the other, and both the kind of possibilities of dissonance, but also what Ferenc said about the notion of good-heartedness in Ferenczi. And I wondered whether being reminded that we are sitting post the Holocaust, and post the traumatic histories that were framed in the second paper, speaking to the mic, because of that, because we're sitting in that position, and because it's taken psychoanalysis so long to find a language within which to engage with those painful and traumatic histories, given that, how do we then think of the earlier papers' discussion, Ferenczi's discussion in the notebooks, in the diaries, about Freud? How do we understand some of the differences and challenges that Ferenczi makes to Freud, either for a more democratic psychoanalytic practice, for the place of good-heartedness or the possibilities of feeling that Ferenczi discovers, Ferenczi's understanding of his own frustrations that he needs to give voice to, even if they challenge the dominant terms of psychoanalytic theory? How do we understand that difference and the tension, what Ferenczi comes to know, and whether that shapes the possibilities of a different kind of psychoanalytic engagement with exactly the kind of traumatic events that the second paper opens up? Difficult question.
That is what the whole conference has been about, I think. So you probably should have come a bit earlier, I think.
listening to the two of you, I was reminded of an image that I had before, which was of Martin Amos talking about the pregnant widow. And thinking, because I think it's quite a powerful image, that of a widow that has to mourn. And as I think, as individuals, we have to mourn idealization. And as a society, we have to mourn all the horrors that we are able and capable of doing. And we have as well to mourn our heroes like Ferenczi and Klein, and the fact that they're no longer alive, and a lot of our very eminent psychoanalysts are dying. And at the same time, the fact of the pregnancy, the fact that there's things, the possibilities for the future that, as Jonathan was saying, are new and we don't know about, but that are there, and hopefully there's something creative coming in the future. But that in the moment, maybe we're very much in between the two positions.
Just a brief observation. The comment about the subterranean Holocaust memorial, it sort of struck me that, you know, that might not be optimal, but at least there is a monument. And, you know, in British public life and in the British education system, the slave trade, which claimed about 11 million people's lives, is, you know, relatively unknown. And you can't go through the German education system without the Holocaust being present all the way through in German education. So just reflecting on that absence in British public life.
Well, just a few seconds. I have been told a few minutes ago something like a joke by Judith Dupont. It's her sentiment about why Freud and Ferenczi were so different, they could not agree together. And she told me, well, maybe we could consider Freud as a joyous pessimist and Ferenczi as a desperate optimist. Thank you, Judith.
Thank you, both of you, for giving us a lot to think about. I'd like to address my, this is a commentary, really, to Jonathan Sklar's talk. I want to address my comment to Jonathan Sklar's talk, which reminded me of a book I read some years ago by George Sebald, Austerlitz. And Austerlitz. And in this book, it starts out as a travelogue, really. It's a nice little train travels through Europe. But then as you go along, you begin to realize that this elderly professor who's retired, who's kind of alone in life, is recreating the past without knowing it. He doesn't know why he's doing this. He's just compelled to retrace steps that he had taken on the Kindertransport when he was separated, ripped off from his family. And as you realize what's happening, you feel really terribly sorry. It's a tragedy that this fellow could not ever have a relationship because of the trauma that he went through. And I think that's, you know, that you're addressing that, you know, the environment can cause a devastating impact on individuals. And they live their lives without knowing it, compelled to do things that are very contained, very restricted.
Thank you. Listening to both of you, I had in my mind all the time another paper that I'm working, that I'm reading for another purposes of the philosopher Jacques Derrida, who published in 1981 a very critical essay, which probably some people here know about. He condemned the IPA for not having the courage to condemn tortures in Argentina, and this is extremely moving article and a very clear one. I'm not I don't know if I understand everything that Derrida is saying in other places, but this is a very recommended one. And he also, I mean, one of his main points is that in those old days, in the 70s, the IPA had three departments. They separated the world to the European branch, the North American branch, and the rest of the world. And this is the name of the article. He called it the geopsychoanalysis and the rest of the world. So everything which is not in Europe was considered as the rest of the world, namely nameless in a sense. And listening to Ferenc, it reminded me that actually Ferenc was the founder of the IPA, as much as I remember. And I wonder if you both can comment. We haven't discussed it in the last 2 days. I think what Ferenc ambivalent feelings towards institutions, and maybe both of you can say something about it, because I think he was always part of it, but against it, or in his mind part of it and in his heart, or the other way around. I don't know.
Okay. I've got the mic, so. No, I just wanted to say how moved I am by both of your presentations, but also by the whole these days, because, and what Jonathan said at the end about this regression into totalitarianism, which is menacing Europe, and maybe more than that. I mean, we're on the edge of this, or at least in our imaginations, we are on the edge of something. And listening to both of you, I was just thinking, how did Ferenc, well, especially Freud and the analysts just before the Anschluss, feel? Did they, you know, how was it within the psyche? How was it in their work with patients? And I'm very, very sensitive to this, because I'm very sensitive to the totalitarian regression in the individual. And I see it as a kind of infantile state, which is all or nothing. Kill or be killed, eat or be eaten, live or die. And that maturity is coming out of that infantile state of all or nothing. And I'm just wondering, you know, what can we do as analysts at a time when we feel this coming on? You know, I mean, and we're made to feel so helpless. If you're listening to the radio every morning as I do, I think, oh God, you know, what other thing is happening now? And then we go to our cabinet and we work with our patients, and we see it reflected also somehow in this kind of, and so, you know, I mean, I'm really very, very involved in this freedom to grow. the question of maturation and just how we can work with this, but, you know, maybe.
I don't recognize any questions this afternoon. I think that the audience, the group, is thinking in many interesting ways, and this isn't a question and answer session as if the two people up here have the answers. In these very interesting things that are being spoken about are the germ of some answers.
Just very briefly to your question. To Catelyn's question, I mean that's it's a very serious question. What did they feel in 1932? And I remember in my paper, it was 1932 was just a common year. Nothing happened, and still, you know, everything happened afterwards. But I think it was not in their consciousness, only in a sort of anxiety. And a very vague feeling of insecurity, but Freud remained in Austria until Anschluss, and Ferenc did not want to emigrate, though Freud wanted to persuade him, and others wanted to persuade him. So they believed in a world. I mean, you know, in the social psychology and sociology, there's the expression "the just world," the belief in the just world, that no one. I mean, I am exempt of all the the tragedy which is happening in the world, but I am a good person, a good-hearted person, therefore nothing can happen to me. But I think that the situation now is different, because I think we are much more conscious of these things, and therefore the regression to authoritarianism can be maybe easily prevented. So we feel that we are living in a pseudo-world in a way, what Jonathan so beautifully described, or not beautifully, but beautifully and very interestingly, because he is a real orator, but what Warsaw looks like. And we live in a way, in a kind of, in Warsaw, a world which is just, the virtual world, and Warsaw, the old city, is a virtual city in a way, and we live in the virtual world, and that creates a lot of new problems. What we see the monuments, but every day is in Warsaw, like on the stage, and there's nothing real in a way, nothing real.
One memory related to Kathleen and also to what Ferry says, that I was interviewing the mature Hungarian analysts who were active before the war, and many, many years ago, straight after, I think I graduated. And the question on our minds, this generation, was how on earth were they able to work in the face of all the Jewish laws or all persecution? What happened? And what I remember most vividly was Imre Herman, who said to me that, we could escape from it for an hour into our consulting rooms. And this is also a thought to take into consideration why analysts, we sometimes don't look outside.
Thank you. I come from the rest of the world. I come from Colombia, South America. And it's been fascinating to hear this set of conferences during the weekend. And I'm very happy to realize that Freud, Ferenczi, Lacan, Klein are kind of finding gradually their correct place in history, sort of, and that the controversies between we call them in South America, the controversies between the British ladies, we call it like that, that they are coming to an end gradually, which is important because those controversies are not only happened here, but they influence the worldwide movement of psychoanalysis. I'm an analyst, certainly. But the big idea comes to my mind when we're finishing this lovely weekend is that perhaps thanks to each of these in history, Ferenczi today, probably that would also allow us to identify what they gave us, and probably that would allow us to let them rest in peace also in a way, and to allow us to get moving for new things, find new, recognize people, because you see we are recognizing Ferenczi now, which is very good, but we might not be recognizing people who are creating new things right now, worldwide, in the U.S. and in the rest of the world, So I think that's one of the most important things that's happening, that identifying the correct place for all these great pioneers will allow us to identify what's happening nowadays and to really look and move into the future. Thank you.
It seems that we have to be finishing. It's rather important to know that we all come from the rest of the world. If you're not in the rest of the world, I think you're in the wrong place. And to go back to the first question, I think the idea is that it isn't about Freud, it isn't about Ferenczi, it's about the dialogue between them. That if we can keep having that real dialogue about how they both thought, because they're both right, they're both wrong, they both miss the point with each other, but that's the great analytic task, I think, to keep refinding that. And I think if analytic societies stop their constant quiet warfare in societies and are able to look out about what's going on in their own nation states, there might be some more energy to speak up in an analytic way about what we think is going on, and we might be heard.
Yes, thank you. I agree with you. I think there was one question, which was an interesting question of Saul about Ferenczi and the institutions. I think he is very ambivalent about the institutions. He has a paper in which he speaks about institutions, organizations, and how an organization can be very, very strongly limiting one's possibilities and resources. And belonging to an organization means a sort of being a kind of slavery, or at least a very underdog position. So I think that it's an interesting question, the institutions and the anti-institutional movements later in the 70s and 80s, and the relation of psychoanalysis to these movements. So I try to mention anti-psychiatry, for example, which took a lot of ideas from Ferenczi, but I think there's someone who wants to speak, but I don't know.
I think we have to finish noses. Yeah, different noses, yes. Or you decide about the announcement, I think. But thank you both very much, and yeah.
Okay. Before we stop for the coffee break, and after that we come back for another session that Kathleen will be facilitating, I think. With you, at least, maybe I'm making a mistake. I'd just like to make an announcement, picking up on maybe something Jonathan said. I think we're always somebody's the rest of the world. But I'd like to announce what we hope will be a real, as it was for this weekend, a real analytic dialogue and thinking space in Toronto in 2015. We put the email at the bottom. We'll be talking a bit more about it when we come back, but just in case people had to leave, I wanted to announce right away that in 2015 in Toronto, in one of the rest of the world, in Canada, there's going to be an international forensic conference. Thank you. And we'll be telling you the details after the break.